welcome to wherever you are. I'm Ryan McNeil from Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to episode 92 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. I say that I am from Toronto, Canada, but as I sit here right now, I am not in Toronto, Canada. I found myself on the annual road trip to the wonderful part of the world that is the United States of America, and I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I've never been before, and I'm visiting friends this time. This is all new to me. I usually go by myself and maybe meet up with somebody or two, but I don't actually like hang out full on and crash with somebody. I really thought you guys would be sick of me by about 11 o'clock tonight, so I'm doing pretty well. My guest, and in this case also my host, is Andrew James of Row 3 Cinecast. How are you tonight, sir?
Oh yeah, you betcha. Doing real well there. Thanks. How have you been doing?
I am dismayed that you guys don't really sound like that. That really just altered my whole reality.
Well, we'll get into that maybe later, but some of us do sound like that.
So. Oh, okay.
And
okay.
If you talk to like guys from Dave from Film Rot or people from Florida or wherever,
yeah,
they absolutely say we sound like that.
Well, it's funny though, because I know that in the past people have told me that that's how my Canadian accent sounds.
Yeah, not too bad.
Exactly.
You get the A and the out and about once in a while, but not much.
Yeah. So I've been in Minneapolis all day. I'll be here again tomorrow, and then before I go home after a very short weekend. This is a lovely city. I really didn't know what to expect. This little trip that I've been on around your country, some of these places, like we were talking about earlier, some of these places have been, I don't want to name them because I feel bad, but some of them have been shitholes. Some of them have been unexpectedly beautiful. And yeah, this is like, there's a lot to this city, and like you kind of turn around a corner and you find yourself in a very different neighborhood.
Yep.
You know, your neighborhood is very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? It's very residential, but there's still stuff like within a short walk, even though you don't like to walk. I walked around like half your quarter of the city today.
Yeah.
Which
there's a lot in that little quarter.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah.
It's very eclectic.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And yeah, like the biggest failing of the day was we couldn't decide on what movie to see.
Yeah.
There were just too many options. It's like, oh, do we see Blackfish? Do we see Two Guns? What do we see?
And if that's the worst of your worries, then you're doing okay. But yeah. I mean, yeah, like you go down and you can go canoeing or you can go to the Mac store. Like how many cities are those are your choices, right?
So yeah, no, it's
lots of stuff.
It's been a lot of fun, and we got some baseball to look forward to tomorrow, and we're gonna go catch a movie finally.
Yeah.
So no, it's gonna be good times. But in honor of my trip, this is not gonna be a normal episode where we record something where we talk about something new, and then choose two films to complement it for the other side. I thought I would talk about two films in honor of this trip to Minneapolis. Because there is a directing team that is so synonymous with this part of the country that I felt I would be remiss if we didn't talk about them. So we're today going to have a shorter and very different sounding Coen Brothers episode. We're not going to do Know Your Enemy, and I've got no feedback on this one. So we're just going to talk about the two films in question, and hopefully you folks enjoy. They're both older. They're both readily available on Blu-ray and on demand and all the usual places. So we're not really spoiling them is kind of going to be a silly discussion. So we are going to talk about them in the complete sense. So maybe if you haven't seen them, you might want to skip it, but I don't really think they're films that can be spoiled. I don't really think that there's that kind of thing. To stop gilding the lily, we are going to talk about Fargo first, and that's from 1986. And then we're going to, after a short break, we'll talk about A Serious Man from 2009. So when I was planning this trip, I said to you, I was like, let's talk about some Coen Brothers movies, which, you know, I don't think I really had to twist your arm too much on doing that as much. So I chose Fargo for reasons I'll get into in a second. And then I said to you, you know, what would you like to pair it up with? And we talked about, for a second, we talked about like Miller's Crossing. And did we talk about Lebowski?
I just assumed Lebowski's been talked about so much. It's just like, you know, why
bother? Right, right. But you then chose, you thought A Serious Man would be a good choice. Yeah. And we actually, as we both watched A Serious Man. I rewatched Fargo. You've seen Fargo like 17,000 times, so you didn't really need to rewatch it. And we found out that there were some similarities. But I wanted to start with Fargo because, so Fargo, of course, was from 1996, directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, and it's about, allegedly, a true crime that happened in the 80s in this part of the country, where somebody, the main guy is Jerry Lundegaard, that's Bill Macy at his Maciest, I think. Yeah. You know, absolute. If this was an episode of your show, that would be the title.
The Maciest?
The Maciest, yes. And he wants to basically scam his in-laws out of money, so he creates this convoluted plot to have his wife kidnapped by two really dumbass hoods and reap the ransom money for himself. The dumbass hoods are played by Steve Buscemi. And what's the nihilist? What's his actual name?
The nihilist. Peter Stormare.
There we go.
I knew it.
So they play the crooks. And when things really go wrong, the whole thing starts getting investigated by Marge Gunderson, and she's played in an Academy Award-winning performance by Frances McDormand. The reason why I chose this movie, along with the fact that it's really, really representative of this part of your country in a certain time of year, is actually the first time I saw this movie, I did not like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I loathed it. For a while, I said that it was the film that made me feel ripped off for the price of a rental. Okay. Right? Like I rented the VHS for whatever it was at the time, $3.99 or $4.99. I was like, that sucked. I can't believe that movie. This is the movie that like Siskel and Ebert are loving, and this is the movie that's up for Best Picture. I was like, I didn't get it.
Okay.
Okay. I was about 18 years old. I was just, I think it, like for about a year, I'd been watching a better class of film, including Fargo. But the concept of like black comedy was completely lost on me.
Mm-hmm.
So when people said that it was really funny, I was just like, I don't get it, right? And that's the whole thing with comedy, right? If it doesn't land for you, you're in for a long night.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now you, of course, like I get the impression that you loved it like right off the go.
Yes. Yeah, I did. And the funny thing is, I think it's hilarious. I think it's super funny. That said, somebody from Toronto or somebody from Phoenix or somebody from Miami, I think I would understand why they wouldn't think it's that funny, because it feels like a whole shitload of in-jokes for 90 minutes or, you know, 120 minutes, however long it is.
It's actually not long. It's like 100 minutes.
Yeah, it's pretty, like 95. It's quick.
Really short.
And I'm sort of realizing that now, just as you saying, I hated it. I'm trying to think, why would you hate it? And because the comedy, for me, it seems to be very down home, very personal. Like all the accent stuff is just crazy ridiculous. And I think to an outsider, maybe. It would be like, okay, that's funny for 2 minutes. Now that shit's just old.
Right.
And then on the other side of the token, people in Minnesota, I remember when the movie came out, a lot of people were kind of offended. Really? Oh, we don't talk like that. It's just making fun of us. It is a little over the top about how we talk. But if you go out into the country a little bit, there's people that talk like that, especially back in the 80s.
Well, I think about it more. Like, I kind of think that especially where the Coen brothers nailed it was there's the one resident who he's talking to the cop about the funny-looking fella was looking for recreation.
Yeah.
And I figured it wasn't on this lake. It must have been on that lake. And he said, oh, it's something suspicious, so I calls it in. Mm-hmm. End of story. That, to me, seems more genuine than Marge and Jerry and Lundegaard, for instance.
If we were doing the regular matinee and you said, what's your souvenir from this movie? It's that
conversation.
Scene. I fucking love that sequence because that is so accurate of like small town Minnesota. A guy not shoveling his driveway.
He's sweeping
the slush off his driveway. And then when they're kind of done with their conversation, they don't really know what to say. And he kind of just looks up at the sky and goes, yeah, she's going to turn cold tomorrow. And then the other cop turns the other way and looks at the sky and goes, yeah, front coming in. Like, that is Minnesota talk.
Okay.
From neighbor to neighbor every day.
Right.
Like, that's what we talk about.
And so that was the kind of thing when you first saw it.
It's just, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
So, and just the way they deliver it is hilarious, too, but...
Yeah. Now, the funny thing that happened is that about 5 years later, but besides the fact that it won awards and, as I said, like, people kept it on lists of, like, the best movies of all time, and that first AFI list, like, that came out, I think, 2 years after this movie, it was on it. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, one of the 100 best movies of all time, and that movie's on it? Holy crap.
Yeah.
So, a few more years passed, and I first really started thinking about it again around 5 or 6 years after it was released, like around 2002. Because the place, the department in my business I was working in at the time, they loved to walk around quoting Fargo. Like, they loved to walk around going, you know, yeah, end the story. Like somebody would come over and give me a set of instructions and then just be done, go, end the story, right? That kind of thing. Or, you know, like, oh, just think I'm going to barf. Like, they would drop lines from...
What you got there? Oh, Arby's. Oh,
yeah, exactly. And it was, it seemed to me at the time, first of all, it seemed like the most random new movie to be quoting endlessly. Like, I know people, we were talking earlier, like, people quote Lebowski, like, No Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. My place of business was quoting Fargo. Like, okay. No Tomorrow. And all of a sudden, just through sure repetition, these things were becoming funny to me. Like I would start to actually kind of crack a grin when somebody... for like, they were also saying, oh, yeah, that just, like, 30 times a day.
Yeah.
No shirt of a lie.
Yeah.
And so it started becoming funny. And then this is where, like, my whole mantra with film came from when I say watch it again. Because I was like, okay, I missed something. Like, I don't know what the hell I was thinking the first time I saw it, because these guys, you walk around the office talking like, you know, Midwestern Americans are really cracking me up. I must have missed something. And I watched it a second time. And first of all, I started laughing. Like, that was the thing. Like, I was watching it by myself on a DVD and I started laughing at it, like, almost right off the draw. Like, there's the conversation in Lundegaard's office about the true coat, which is, it's absurd. And, like, I think that was the thing. The first time I saw it, I was like, what is this argument? What is going on?
Yeah.
You know? And then now, as rewatching it, and just rewatching that customer's expression and his way of dealing with Jerry, which is no way at all, which is just keep on yelling and finally surrender.
Yeah.
That cracked me up.
That's Minnesota. And, like, you can see when he finally decides to swear, you're a fucking liar.
Yeah.
Like, it's really hard for him to actually swear.
And the wife is just, like...
Yeah.
The wife is just placating him, right? Yeah, like, she's just like, it's okay. You know, she's in just the most, you know, absolutely toothless way possible. Mm-hmm. She's just, you know... So that was the thing. So I watched it again after, you know, as I said, 6 or 7 years after I first seen it.
Yeah.
And I found myself laughing. I ended up, I was like, okay, I'm going to buy this. And the more I watch it, like, I don't even need the line to happen. I just need to see the moment begin, and I'm already snickering.
Yeah.
To, like, you know, that was what was happening when I was watching it in advance of this trip. I was doing 16 different things while I was watching, because I've seen it. I haven't seen it as many times as you, but I've seen it 6 or 7 times. So I already knew where some of these conversations were going, and I was already cracking a smile. So that's kind of one of the reasons why I chose it, is because the Coen brothers were not a set of filmmakers that I really warmed to when I was first getting into film. I was all over Steven Spielberg, you know, that and that kind of thing. I was more down something that's straight down the middle.
It's populist. It's bad, but
there's like a lot of their films, not just Fargo, but a lot of their films, even leading into it, have little moments of absurdity that you either just go with and shrug your shoulders and go, well, you know, that happened. Or you fixate on it and say, but I don't get fill in the blank, whether it's the hats or whether, you know, in Miller's Crossing, or I don't get, you know, this happening or that happening. And that was me when I was, you know, 18, 19, 17, 18, 19. I was like, I don't get why I don't get why this is funny. I don't get why this is happening, or I don't get why that's happening. Mm-hmm. And that was my thing. And I still say, like, to a lot of people who come to the Coen brothers, they don't dig them. Maybe because they're that particular Midwest brand of humor.
I can appreciate that or understand that. I think that they're not all their movies. I mean, you look at Oh Brother, Where Art Thou or Barton Fink. We shouldn't do a Coen retrospective here, but I just think that Fargo and A Serious Man in particular are very pointed towards not only Minnesota, but like Minneapolis culture, especially. Right. Like in Fargo, there's a lot of references to the skyline when they go to Embers. That Embers is about four blocks away from my high school girlfriend's house.
Okay.
Like, I've been there a million times. They talk about certain things within the city that are not even like, you don't even know that they're icons until they're mentioned in the movie. There's a particular scene where Lundegaard goes to his father with all the numbers. He's trying to get the bank, the deal worked out.
$750,000.
Yeah, that's a chunk. Yeah. Or that's a lot, yeah. He says. Yeah.
That's a piece.
and he said, if I don't see anything like that in here, any insurance or whatever. If I want that, I'll go down to North Star and talk to old Bill Deal. And as somebody from wherever, it's just a part of the dialogue from Minneapolis. Old Bill Deal was a guy that was on WCCO radio, and his commercials were on every 5 minutes, and he worked at... And then, even after that line, they have a quick interchange about, oh, is he down at Twin City Federal? No, he's over at North Star now. Like, that's all Minnesota intricacies,
right,
that nobody else would get, except, right, for the Coen brothers and people who lived in the cities in the 80s. So, like, that kind of stuff, somebody from wherever watching that would just be like, oh, that's kind of weird, pointless dialogue, or they just don't latch onto it. So I can just see somebody not being as entertained as me going, yeah, that's hilarious. And there's even more of those references in A Serious Man. Yeah, I think it's very much their own thing. It's their own dealings with. It's a pretty basic story. Like, mm-hmm, it's kidnapping and a satchel of money and bad guys and good guys, and then they just wrap it all around crazy dialogue, crazy accents, extreme caricatures of suburbia.
Yeah,
and
a bad situation getting worse.
Yeah. And for some reason that all works, and I have to sort of agree with you that it's weird that Siskel and Ebert and all these critics at the time would just love it, because as I try to picture this movie from somebody on the outside, I'm not sure that I would have loved it right from the outside.
Well, they're Midwest. I don't know about the rest of them, but Siskel and Ebert are both Chicago boys, right?
And yeah,
and Ebert especially, like he was from Indiana.
Okay.
So, you know, not to generalize or anything, but Midwesterners, you share commonalities from, you know, as a foreign observer.
True.
As a foreign observer.
Yep.
But that may be. It may be that the ones that were leading the charge were the ones who grew up in the Midwest and then branched out to places, you know, like Chicago and New York and that, mm-hmm, kind of thing. The funny thing as well that the one thing that, watching it this week, that I kind of had to give my head a shake is I said to myself, okay, I can understand 18-year-old me not getting it, in air quotes, mm-hmm, that people could see if this was an audio.
Yeah.
But what I couldn't understand was the two things that I watched it this time and I was like, holy crap, is how good this movie looks and how good this movie sounds with that score. I was like, what the hell was wrong with me?
Yeah.
Right? But just those two things. Like, it wasn't the start of them working with Deakins. That was...
Oh, he's been with them for a long time. Yeah.
It was something before then. Like, he was working with them, like, on Hudsucker. Miller's Crossing was somebody else. It was Barry Levinson. But he'd been working with them for a few by the time they got to this.
Yep.
But this was, you know, this is definitely one of his movies. Those scenes out in the snow,
mm-hmm,
look awesome. Whether it's that high shot of Jerry Lineker going out to his car, and you've got all those planter boxes. Oh, it's
such a great scene. Yeah.
Or those scenes of this in this of like the car driving through the snow, where it's usually just like a white screen, and then you finally mm-hmm. see like a grill and headlights, and it slowly yeah. comes through the white.
Yeah, yeah. Quickly on that, if you've ever been out in the country late at night, there's in the one scene where the cop is coming up on Steve Buscemi, the lights come and it just takes forever for them to kind of come over the hill. He sees lights coming, and it just takes forever for them to get there. That is so true. And then I love where Peter Stormare hops in the driver's seat and chases after the couple yeah. that witnesses the murder. And he's chasing them and he's chasing them. And all of a sudden the red taillights just disappear.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I really like those shots because the whole screen's black yeah. pretty much.
Yeah.
Except those red lights and they go out. But yeah, everything is just gorgeous.
Yeah, and really, and that very
even the minimal stuff.
Yeah, and that very unique score, that kind of like fiddle music that,
and it's very slow.
It's almost like
and
a hurdy-gurdy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Very very slow. Nothing
that sound, overly that intense. Sound you hear is like a few dozen people Googling hurdy-gurdy right now.
Well, it's not Hitchcockian.
No.
Even though it's a fiddle kind of and moody.
Yeah.
It's not like intense, yeah. really. It's
so that was the thing. Like, you know, I as I said, like 18-year-old me might not have got black humor, mm-hmm. but he certainly could appreciate good score and good looks. So I was like, what the hell was wrong with that kid? The other cool thing that I was thinking about when I watched it is it's very much a sign of its time in the way that I do remember at the time there was a question of whether or not it was based on a true story. Because that's the title card that comes up first.
Yep.
Is based on a true story. I think it even gives the year, doesn't it? Like, I think this is like 1987.
It might have, yeah.
But nobody had any way of proving that. Because this was just before the dawn of the internet. And nobody really seemed to be able to find the story. The Coens were screwing around with everybody saying, yeah, no, it was absolutely true. The same way that they would later on in a few different, like they would say that Oh Brother Where Art, that was based on the Odyssey,
yep.
even though they never actually read it, that kind of thing. And that was the thing that's one of those things that I think actually is very, very representative is you think for a few moments that you are actually watching an actual scene play out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at the time, if something says on screen based on a true story,
you believe it.
That's what it is. Yeah. And I think, I don't know, did you do any limited research?
No, I have no idea. As far as I know, I'm pretty sure it's been disproven.
Yeah, it's based on something like really lightly. Yeah. Something. Like
not only that, but it's been, you know, it's been 15 years pretty much since it, actually it's been more than 15 years since it came out, and they've just backed off the claim. They're like, ah, no, it is what it is now. We know it. It's you know, it's yeah. achieved its thing. Yeah, we made it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Off of an idea that they got from a headline maybe mm-hmm. or something. Because there was some nugget of truth right. to it. Which is kind of interesting. I don't know how big of a tangent you want to go off on this, but like, so The Conjuring came out this last week, and yeah. that whole thing is based on a true story. And there's been a bunch of movies lately that have been saying based on a true story, based on a true story. And at this point, you know, there was a time when you saw based on a true story, and it made the movie so much more interesting.
Yeah.
If it was. Now I see that, and every time I see based on a true story or inspired by a true story, I think,
bullshit. Yeah,
probably not.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean anything. Don't even put that up there. No. It doesn't even mean anything anymore.
Right.
Where 15 years ago, that meant something. It was like, oh, fuck, that's cool.
Yeah.
You watch something like, what's the documentary from last year about the fast food?
Oh, I watch,
she gets strip searched and the fake phone call by the cop and the,
oh, why did it just fall out of my head?
Oh, I hate these. It was in a shitload of top tens. But, I mean, that is really close to being a true story, right? Yeah. It starts with a C, right?
It does.
A C-O-N, I think, even.
It'll come to us.
Keep
talking and we'll come up with it.
So, well, I guess just my point is, outside of that movie, which I know for a fact is based on a true story and made it even more frustrating, outside of that, all these sort of fictionalized films that say based on a true story, it just doesn't mean anything anymore. It doesn't impact me like it would have 15, 20 years ago. Because well, I just don't care. Now I'm just thinking. Now what I'm thinking, actually,
this isn't even bringing into consideration the Blair Witch Project 3 years later, which again blurred that line of is it real or did they just totally make this up?
And so now it's actually for me personally, it kind of has a backfire effect. If it says based on a true story, I automatically think. Bullshit. It's not based on a true story.
Compliance.
Minus points. Compliance, yes. Minus points on your movie trying to bullshit me.
You're starting 1 or 2 points.
In the yeah, middle. Like right away with The Conjuring, they said it's based on a true story. Oh, come on. It's exorcisms and ghosts, and it's not fucking based on a true story. No. Don't put that up there.
No. And, so here's another funny thing that I noticed, or another interesting thing about this movie that I noticed this week is that for how synonymous Frances McDormand is with this movie and Marge Gunderson as a character is with this movie, she doesn't show up until like the second act.
I know.
She's missing for the whole first 30 minutes,
mm-hmm.
Which is all, it's all the plot and it's all, it's all the funny looking guy and the big fella. And it's Jerry Lundegaard being his Lundegaardian best. And then when shit gets real, that's when Marge shows up. She's only really, like, she sits out the entire first act. She's kind of the anti-Janet Leigh.
And
it's amazing that they could write a story where they could have such an iconic character who's such a big presence in the movie and just say, they're not even going to enter into this fray until things really start going down after mm-hmm. 30 minutes.
And isn't her character introduction, where is her introduction?
She's in bed.
Yeah.
She gets the phone call at like first
thing. And it's her and her husband waking up and making eggs and coffee. And then that's another just great scene where it's just the shot of the kitchen. The husband's still eating breakfast. She goes outside. It totally takes its time.
Yeah.
And you're just waiting. You're just watching this guy eat eggs. And then she comes back in. She's like, I need a jump. That's Minnesota. Fucking, we got to jump the car.
So figuring that out was amazing. Along mm-hmm. with now, okay, so you were talking about the patience of that kind of thing. The one thing that I'm left with this movie, and with movies that they've done like it, is if they didn't have the kind of muscle that they do now, if they weren't like capital T, capital C, capital B, the Coen brothers, and they faced a lot more pressure. If they made a movie like this, I could foresee a studio head saying, you know that Mike Yamagita scene? We don't need that.
No.
You know, I could see a studio...
Absolutely.
I could see a studio saying that serves no purpose. Because the truth of the matter is, it doesn't, really. It teaches us something about Marge, of course. But there's a lot of other things that do. The thing is, you take that out and you're missing something so amazing.
Yeah, I can't. All I can say is I agree completely because it's such a needless scene, but it's fucking amazing.
Yeah,
and I've watched a lot of interviews with directors and editors, and they always say, as hard as it is, you gotta cut those scenes out. And no matter how amazing they are, if they don't mean anything, if they're just there because you like them, you gotta get rid of them.
Yeah.
And that's why you'll get a lot of good deleted scenes and stuff on DVDs
sometimes, or whatever. Sometimes they're cut.
In this case, how could you possibly cut that out? It's so good.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't even know why it's good. Again, outside of it's funny because it's Minnesota accent. It's an Asian guy doing Minnesota accent. He's talking about Minnesota things, Honeywell and 3M, and
he's talking. But also, it's the absurdity of the whole situation that somebody and you know what? The funny thing is, I bet you it happens every week that some dude out there or some woman out there calls on a complete long shot. Hail Mary pass, somebody who they used to know.
Yeah.
Thinking,
you know,
there's somebody who I always liked, and I just didn't tell them I liked them. Maybe now if I tell them I like them, things will, you know, things will be awesome. And remind me, doesn't it come out at the end that, like, Yamagita's wife didn't actually die?
Yeah. She's talking on the phone with her friend.
Yeah.
He made everything up.
And yeah.
Yeah. He's just really, he's actually disturbed and troubled. He's living with his parents or something. Yeah.
Oh man. No, so that was the thing, was first of all just
it was a film that for me just grew on me and grew more and more. That even like even when I did like it, like even when I watched it that second time in like 2002 or whenever it was, and I was like, no, like no, this movie's pretty badass. I was like, still look at the Mike Yamagita shit. And then I bought myself a copy and I watched it for a third time. It's like, oh, okay, Yamagita's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And then just like everything started to just kind of piece itself together. I don't know if it is the quintessential Coen Brothers movie. Like that's kind of a whole other argument, I think, because I think it kind of depends on which version of the Coen Brothers you like. But I certainly think it's one of them for sure.
It seems to be people's like go-to masterpiece. That's my gut reaction whenever somebody says, "What's your favorite Coen Brothers movie?" My gut reaction is Fargo, and then I start to think a little bit, and maybe it's not Fargo, but Fargo's definitely in the top three or four.
I kind of think that there's directors like the Coen Brothers and like Stanley Kubrick, there's a whole bunch, and unfortunately, a bunch of them are escaping me at the moment. But I sort of think there's an order that you got to watch them, otherwise you'll kind of be put off.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that Fargo is like the entry point. Like if somebody wanted to get into the Coen Brothers right this moment and they'd never seen anything, I'd tell them to like either watch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou or Le Big Lebowski. You know, and then kind of roll from there. And probably like after that, watch No Country for Old Men.
Yeah,
I don't know that I'd get to either one of the two films we're talking about today until they've seen a whole bunch. And like I would throw Raising Arizona in there, like that's them at their Coen-iness, Coen-est, I should say.
Yeah,
I think.
Which is funny because I think Fargo is really the movie that broke them out as far as names.
I mean,
Raising Arizona, I feel like was kind of big at the time, but it didn't make them a household name by any means. No. I think it was Fargo that really put them on the map and had really people talking about
it. But would you, as I said, like if somebody was starting into the Coen Brothers, would you start them with Fargo?
No, but you said...
You wouldn't put it towards the end either.
Well, I don't even know where... You said Oh Brother and Lebowski. I was going to say, I don't even really know where I would put... Some, like, where do you jump in on a Coen Brothers movie?
That's what I'm saying. If somebody wanted to start...
Oh,
that's what I'm saying. I would start... I'd say, if you have never seen a Coen Brothers movie and you want to start right now...
That's a tough question.
My answer is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou and or The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm fine with that. Cool. I wouldn't say jump in with Barton Fink.
No.
So, the only last thing I would say that I think is kind of interesting about Fargo is I remember, I was like, "Mom, you gotta watch this, it's great." And she went to the theater, my parents both went to the theater to watch the movie, and she came home and she said, I loved it, but there's way too much violence and there's way too much swearing. And, you know, at the time, I kind of shrugged it off. And I'm thinking back now, it's kind of interesting because the whole movie is totally wholesome.
Yeah.
Like, it's all, geez, oh, golly, yeah, you betcha. Kind of that kind of stuff.
You're a bald-faced liar.
Yeah. Yeah. When, like I said before, when that one guy says, "You're a fucking liar," it's really hard for him to say.
Yeah.
It's clearly a struggle. It's like a big deal when he says it. It's these two outsiders, not from Minnesota, not part of the Minnesota nice, quote unquote.
Also not from North Dakota, where most of this really shakes down.
The whole thing does take place in Minnesota. It's just that the name of the movie Fargo, Fargo is in North Dakota.
Right. How far is that from here?
From here, 4.5 hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just one of those things.
I don't really know why they. Because I think, are they from Fargo, the two outsiders?
Could be.
I can't remember, but I don't remember what Fargo has to do.
Maybe it's just an easier name for a movie than Minneapolis.
Probably.
You know?
Well, they come from Brainerd. The cop is from Brainerd. And they talk about Babe and the Blue Ox. And
right.
That's the whole Brainerd thing.
Steve Buscemi's kind of like John Travolta in Pulp Fiction in the way that every time he's around, things get bad or things go worse.
Yeah.
You know?
And I kind of feel like that's what it is. Like, whenever he's around, it's very vulgar.
Yeah.
Like, he's screaming at the TV, or he's making fun of this poor woman, or he's or Peter Stormare shooting people in the head, you know, like it's really violent and really vulgar. He's a fucking asshole. Like he just comes in and
look at the way he talks to like the parking lot.
The parking lot. That guy's trying to be so friendly. He's like, I'm sorry, sir, you have to pay the five. Fucking bullshit, you asshole.
You and you clip on tie.
Yeah, just demeans him, right?
Yeah.
And in Minnesota, yeah, there's assholes, of course. But in general, like, the joke in Minnesota is you say sorry when it's the other person's fault. You say, oh, I'm sorry, even though it's their fault.
Unless they're stepping on your shoes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then you're a butthole.
Apparently.
So.
Cool.
But it's just kind of weird that the whole movie is super wholesome, except for these two guys that come in and kind of make everything really gritty and shitty. Okay.
Cool. Well, that's Fargo from 1996. And, you know, in case you haven't figured it out, we both think that you should watch it. We're going to take a really short break, and we'll be back right after this with the, I guess, the other side of this. Right after this, so come on back. When the truth is found to be. Your choice when I kind of, you know, approached you with this, basically my other side format for another film to marry up with Fargo, was you went with A Serious Man from 2009, which I thought was a really, really interesting choice, because back to what I was saying about there's an order in which to take the Coen Brothers movies, A Serious Man is at the end of that order. If somebody's coming to the Coens for the first time, this is, I really don't mean this badly, but this is them at their Jewiest. This is them at their most Minnesotan, at their Coen-iness, as far as it can possibly go, where that absurd humor that I didn't get the first time in Fargo is on steroids.
Yeah.
But it is an amazing movie. And it's not really about any... It's about this one guy and how absurd his life becomes. His wife wants to divorce him. His child is getting ready for a bar mitzvah while being a, you know, basically like kind of a truant student who's only worried about watching F Troop. His brother is crashing with them indefinitely and, you know, doing some weird gambling shit and continually draining the cyst on his neck. And a family friend is who the wife wants to move in with.
Mm-hmm.
It all sounds very dramatic, but it's when you put it on screen, it's a very kind of low boil.
Yeah, well, I'll be really honest with you. When you asked me to pair Fargo with something, the only reason I said A Serious Man is because it's the one Coen Brothers movie that I've only seen once.
Really?
And I really wanted to rewatch it.
Okay.
Honestly what it was.
Wow.
I'm like, this has been on my table to watch forever. This will give me an excuse to finally pop it in. And as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, wow, this is such a great companion piece to Fargo. Because you're right, it's not... Like, Fargo has a story, kinda. Like, it's just a guy. It does. It's a guy, and he's whatever. But it's, you know, it's mostly about the jokes with the Minnesota thing and having the dialogue. And here, The Serious Man, or A Serious Man... As I'm watching it, I'm thinking, it's kind of the same thing. There's not much of a story. It's a guy dealing with pressures from here, pressures from there, pressures from over there, and more pressures from here. And just when he's got as much on his plate as he can handle, here's the fucking Columbia Record Club calling.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know? And it's not really about anything other than that, I don't feel like, except for all the Jew stuff. Right. It's Jew stuff and Minnesota stuff kind of pushed together.
Right. Like I said to you, when I saw this movie, I live not terribly far away from one of Toronto's very Jewish centers in terms of neighborhoods. And I saw it by myself. Like, I didn't go with anybody else I knew. There were a few dozen other people in the theater. they were laughing at stuff that was sailing right over my head.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I kind of feel too Goyan to really be enjoying this movie. It's like, I really wish I was understanding some of these moments. And it's not going to be the same as having one of my Jewish friends explain to me why it's funny. If you have to explain the joke, it's not going to work. Right. Right. But that's the thing. Like, don't get me wrong. A lot of the stuff, like, we're sitting shiva here. that landed.
You're
like,
what?
Yeah. I got that. You know, but just even hearing, like, my theater cracked up at the mere mention of the name Cy Abelman, you know, which I guess, sure, okay. But I'm sure, like, that's very funny for a way. I don't know about you. For me, this was the first movie, or this is the first anything I ever saw Michael Stuhlbarg.
Yeah, me too, as far as I know. I mean, maybe he's something minor and something else, but yeah, as far as I know, me too.
And he is really what sells this whole movie, because he plays, aghast and confused and bemused and just desperate, like few other actors can.
Yeah, he's the Jeffrey Lebowski of this movie. Like, he's so good with his facial expressions and his sort of Jerry Lewis-like reactions to things and just... it's classic, like, the way he reacts to things or tries to respond to things. I feel like it's all just really classic comedy, and he just nails it at every stretch.
Yeah, like, you know, even like you mentioned Santana Abraxas, which... I have never wanted to listen to a record more than Santana Abraxas after watching this movie. Hearing him argue with Columbia House Records about this album, anybody else would have just left it like on a very, very low simmer. He just continues to get more and more frustrated to the point where he's basically screaming the words Santana Abraxas into the phone.
Is that a Canadian thing, by the way? Do you know what Columbia Records?
Oh yeah, I didn't do anything.
Yeah. That's why we sent you stuff.
Yeah.
Oh wait, what?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I kind of worry. That's one of those jokes that I worry that it doesn't land. I think that's an age thing. Like, I don't even know if they're still around.
Nah, they couldn't be. Why would they be?
Yeah.
Maybe, but...
I'd be surprised. I've been surprised by Stranger Things. But, you know, and I've seen him do so many different things. Like, it's crazy to think that was not even 5 years ago. Because I've seen him do so many things since then. And he's such a talented dude. And he has so many, like, you know, even just his little moment in Hugo. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, his really intense part on Boardwalk Empire, which I know you haven't really got into that show, but he's really, really, like, cold and calculating on that show. Or even just, like, his little... he's got his great little cameo at the beginning of Seven Psychopaths. He's such a good actor. He came from the stage. He's done, like, a lot of Broadway stuff. Like drama, not musicals. He's done a lot of drama, which I can see. Because I can see his voice really, really... And his, like, even just his posture, you know, like, I think about him standing up in front of that class. I think about him trying to cajole the receptionist into letting him in to see Rabbi Marshak.
Yeah.
But beyond just him, because he is amazing, you said to me earlier on today that part of what makes this movie work is, again, like Fargo, it is very, very Minnesota, and there's things in it that one might not get if they weren't from this area.
Yeah. I mean...
So, well, like you were saying, like, even just the Red Owl, which, again, I assume was something they just made up.
Which they totally didn't.
No.
Like, I grew up, my mom saying, going down to the Red Owl to get, you know, whatever, eggs and bread and stuff, and... It's weird. It's not even funny. Like, I'm watching it, I'm like, this is funny.
No.
But it's an iconic piece of nostalgia.
This is really funny.
Fucking, totally. With the logo of the thing, and then they mention it later. Oh, it's in Bloomington, Minnesota. Like, and that isn't even a Minnesota thing. That's a very specific area of the suburbs of Minneapolis. Like, you had to live in the southwest suburbs of Minneapolis to get that joke.
They have, like, four stores?
Yeah, there was Hopkins and St. Louis Park and Minnetonka and Bloomington.
Okay.
And I lived in Minnetonka.
Oh, okay.
And it was like, maybe there was a few others, but in general, like, that was it.
Right.
And so anybody else watching it, and I do this every time we review a Coen Brothers movie on our show, but I always talk about this stuff, and it's just like, and again, it's not funny to me. I don't laugh at it like, haha. It's just more of like a, fuck yeah, I remember the Red Owl. It's interesting that they popped that in there to make it so much more realistic and believable. Yeah.
The other funny thing is, like, a movie that I was telling you about today that I watched, what, like, before I came down here, was I just, because it happened to be there on the shelf, and I thought it'd be fun to have it on while there were other people in the apartment, was I put on Scott Pilgrim. Mm-hmm. And there are things that amuse me because they're Toronto things.
Right.
That I catch, or a person in Toronto catches, that nobody else may catch.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So,
they're not necessarily funny. It's just that you kind of smile to yourself, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guarantee you, when the Coen brothers are putting this together, they're smiling at particular instances that they had at their synagogue.
Right.
The fears that they had when they had to do the thing that the kid does.
The bar mitzvah. Or when he goes up to read the Torah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, or the fears when they're meeting the head rabbi guy.
Yeah.
Whatever that's called. Or things when they mention words like a get. How many people say, what's a get?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? They're having just as much fun with those laughs as they are throwing in Ron Meshbesher and throwing in the Red Owl and throwing in all these little icons. Like, it's their own. I think this is kind of funny that I'm putting this in there. If you don't get it, that's your problem.
That's your problem. Yeah. You know, it's, again, like Fargo, it's deceptively handsome.
Yeah.
It probably more so, because here, like, you know, it's just, it's, at this point, it's 13 years later, they're just using better tools,
mm-hmm.
right? Not to take it, it's Roger Deakins again, he's shooting them both. It couldn't be more different, because here he's shooting a summer, you know, versus in Fargo, of course, he's shooting a winter.
Mm-hmm.
But he's making, like, 1960s suburban Minnesota look really good. Yeah. I wasn't here in the 60s, let alone, you know, let alone here. But I have no idea if he's making it look awesome or not. I've always said, like, again, to bring it back to my hometown, maybe I'm, you know, homesick 12 hours after being here, I don't know. But again, to bring it back to my hometown, I got to actually say to Sarah Pauly that, I really did talk to her. Because of the way it makes Toronto look. It's this really, really romanticized, very sexy summer portrait of Toronto. I was like, and what's interesting is that city does not exist. I live here. Mm-hmm. I know what the city is like and where it goes and everything like that. And that was what she said. She goes, well, that's true. And maybe it was in my brain playing like the ideal version. Of that. So I don't know. Again, I'm not from here, and I certainly wasn't around the 60s, so I don't know if that's an accurate look, like look of Minnesota, like suburban Minneapolis in 1960, whatever, or if it's their ideal, like their rose-colored glasses of what growing up here would be.
I wasn't here either, obviously, but I would bet it's actually pretty close to how it was. I feel like with the characters that they've introduced, yeah, they're over the top and caricatures again, but I think in the 60s, especially in suburban Minnesota, that's what it was. Way spaced out houses, lots of green, everybody kept
big cars.
Shit pristine because,
yep.
And even if there was crazy shit going on the house, on the outside of the house, everything looked normal or nice as possible. Like,
yeah.
Almost like a competition. Like, when he gets mad about our neighbor, he mowed, like, a foot into our yard again. And she's like, so? I don't know. That's sort of, like, that's, like, adding your art to somebody else's art, kind of.
Okay.
I got that kind of feel
right.
to it. Like, that is kind of a big deal. This is my space. I'm going to make this how I want it to look. That's your space. I don't know. I think that's kind of what it was.
Yeah. No, the look of this movie, it's like Mad Men with more Jews.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and without the ads, it's crazy because again, I wouldn't. Somebody says to me, I want to watch a Coen Brothers movie. It's not even like the first five that I recommend to them. Mm-hmm. But yet it is so essential and so very good.
The thing I caught mostly on this second watch was it's way funnier than I remember. It's a comedy. It's Fargo, just the Jew version.
Yeah.
It's
and less violent.
And less way less violent. But it's got that, all sort of there we same go. Reactions. Okay,
it's the one that you wanted to show your parents.
Yeah, exactly. If they were Jewish.
I don't think they need to be.
No, they don't. You just have to be able to sort of sympathize is the wrong word.
No, I just think you have to understand a little bit. Be prepared that there's going to be stuff that just sails over you. Like, yeah, I still don't get why Cy Abelman, the name, is funny. I get why Cy Abelman himself is funny, because he's nuts.
Yeah.
But I still don't get
the name, you don't get.
But yeah.
There's a vocabulary that's probably funnier to somebody who has been to shul.
Yeah.
And there's symbolism, I think, that, like, I can't remember what you call it, and my Jew friends are going to kill me for it. The thing that you hang in your... There's a moment where he goes to knock on the woman's door,
okay.
And there's the thing hanging in the doorway. It's a little metal piece, and he sees it and decides not to knock on the door and walks away. Huh. That's a Jewish thing. You hang it in your door. I can't remember. I have lots of Jewish friends, and hopefully they're not listening. But,
some of mine might be, and please, as I said, like I want to know these
things.
Yeah, throw your comments in there.
Yeah,
I'm always interested in
It's a thing. It's a religious thing to let people know this is a Jewish home, and this is what we believe.
Yeah.
And so there's all sorts of that stuff, and I feel like a lot of it I am getting just from having Jewish friends and living in St. Louis Park, where this movie takes place.
Yeah.
And then some of it is universal, like... Kids in school, okay, I never had to go up front and, like, sing a foreign language, basically, too. But I did go through communion, which is kind of the Protestant equivalent, where you have to know the Ten Commandments, and you have to know
while your friends and family are watching.
Yeah, you have to know these things, and the pastor may ask you a question. And the way they shoot the kid, where he does... He kind of cares because he needs to know it, but he's way more worried about the $20 that he owes
and the
bully.
And the fact that he's toked up right before doing it.
Yeah, which is all just amazing.
Yeah. And then you get...
And then you get
that great look from his friend, who's also equally stoned.
Yeah.
And equally panicked. He's like, he doesn't say a word, but his eyes are just like, dude.
Yeah, really? You're going to do this?
Yeah.
The way they express his fears as he's walking towards the creepy old... Like, he looks up at this painting, and it's full of death and chaos. And he's looking at weird shit, and then he looks at the
rabbi.
The rabbi. They express his fears so well that I'm like, I'm right on board with this kid. Yeah. I know what he's feeling, even though I'm 35.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing, amazing movie. As I said, I do remember when I reviewed it, even though I didn't get everything, I loved the holy heck out of it, and I just had so much fun. I was like, this is a 4-star movie. Even if you don't understand it, even though it is very dense, and it's not the kind of thing that I think a movie fan should go straight to without seeing stuff like Fargo and No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
It's a film that's just totally amazing, and as you've been pointing out to me all day, very very Minnesota.
Yeah, it's totally Minnesota. So. It's all these. I mean, there are places that are shot that you recognize. Souvenir.
For me, I do love that F Troop is always funny.
Oh, that is always funny. His reaction. When he's at the lawyer's office and his son calls, and says, F Troop is fuzzy, and he just doesn't even know how to respond.
Yeah.
He's just like,
this is...
Really?
Yeah.
And he doesn't even say that, but you can see that that's what he's thinking.
Yeah, Stuhlbarg is... Again, he puts that on his face, and that's what makes him so good.
Yeah.
That props to... Like, for the love of God, props to the Coen brothers for finding this guy wherever they found him, like plucking him from just like B-rolls and supporting bits and putting him out front there, because like he owes them his career.
Yeah. Really, if you know, if you ask me. But that's, yeah, the Dad, F Troop is all fuzzy. I will never get tired of hearing that.
Totally.
Yeah. So there we go. Two Coen Brothers movies that you can watch to get a little taste of what's going on around me. Throw in the fact that I found out I do not like sake and I'm not that good at cornholing, and you've got what my weekend is all about. I'm sure I'll mention this a few more times tomorrow. But just like while people are listening, thank you very much for putting me up and for, you know, being really excited to do this kind of thing. I kind of invited myself. I was like, would you be okay with this? And you're like, dude, come on down. So I'm very grateful, and that's awesome. So this has been episode 92 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday. It's a short rest here. Episode 93, we'll be talking about Elysium. Looking very forward to that. Andrew's show is pretty much weekly, 10 days-ish, on row3.com. I have a hunch I'll be appearing on the next one, but I'm not dead certain. Do you guys...
Kurt's schedule is kind of weird now because he's
in Newfoundland
vacationing all the time
again.
I need to work at Xerox, but we are going to talk eventually. We're going to talk a little bit about Two Guns, I think, and The Act of Killing.
And
Europa Report is on video on demand, so
you showed me the trailer for that and that looks awesome,
so we're going to check that out.
So do look for that. Where can people follow you and the site on Twitter?
Twitter.com/row3. I am personally at Andrew_James.
Awesome. I am, of course, the owner and proprietor of thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find episodes through iTunes. You can also find them on Stitcher Radio and using apps like the Apple Music, the Apple Podcasting app. There's another one for Google Android, but I can't remember what the hell it is. I do know that Listen doesn't work anymore.
We started one of all of us.
Oh, and there's the podcasting app that I forget about. Anyway, there's lots of ways to subscribe. Go to the site. You can find new episodes all the time. I love feedback, so if you got any thoughts about the Coen Brothers or either one of these two movies, let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Any final thoughts? None. Cool. I'm going to get some sleep, and then we're going to watch some baseball in the morning.
Rock and roll.
Awesome. For Andrew James, I'm Ryan McNeil in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We'll see you at the matinee.